Kunjabihari. Gopi Janavalaba Girivaradari. Gopi Janavalaba Girivaradari. Yasoda Nandana Prajajanaranjana. Yasoda Nandana Prajajanaranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivaradari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivaradari. Yasoda Nandana Prajajana Ranjana. Yasoda Nandana Prajajana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivaradari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivaradari. Yasoda Nandana Prajajana Ranjana. Yasoda Nandana Prajajana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Kishore Kishori Ki Jai. Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Maharani Ki Jai. Thank you for kindly excusing yourself. It's very thoughtful of you. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Gornitai ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. So Today is continuing Canto 10. It's the beginning of chapter 25. So today we'll be covering text 2, text 3, and text 4. So text 2. Ganam Savartakam Namam. Ganam Savartakam Namam. Megana Chanta Charinam. Meganam Kanta Charinam. Indra prachodayat krodho. Indra prachodayat krodho. Vakyam jahesha mani atam. Vidyam kahesha mani etam. Uta, sorry. Ganam Savartakam Nama. Ganam Savartakam Nama. Meganam Kanta Karinam. Meganam Kanta Karinam. Indra Prachodayat Krudho. Indra Prachodayat Krudho. Vakyam Kahesha Mani Uta. Vakyam Kahesha Mani Uta. So the word for word translation. Granam, the group. Samvartakam Nama, name Savartaka. Meganam. Sorry. Of clouds, cha, and antakarinam, who erect, sorry, who effect the end of the universe, Indra, Indra, prachodayat, sent forth, krodaha, angry, vakyam, words, cha, and aha, spoke. Ishamani, falsely thinking himself the supreme controller. Uta, indeed. So the translation for text 2 is as follows. Angry Indra sent forth the clouds of universal devastation, destruction, known as Samvartaka. Imagining himself the supreme controller, he spoke as follows. So purport for text 2. The word Ishamani here is very significant. Indra arrogantly considered himself to be the Lord, and thus he exhibited the typical attitude of a conditioned soul. Many thinkers in the 20th century have noted the exaggerated sense of individual prestige characteristic of our culture. Indeed, writers have even coined the phrase, the me generation, in inverted commas, the me generation. Everyone in this world is more or less guilty of the syndrome called Ishamana, or proudly considering oneself the Lord. And text 3. Aho Shri Madha Mahatmayam. Aho Shri Madha Mahatmayam. Gopanam Kanano Kasham. Gopanam. Oh, sorry, this one we're not chanting responsibly, sorry. Gopinam kanana kasham Krishna matyam upashrityam ye chakrur devahetanam. In the translation for text 3. Indra said, Just see how these cowherd men living in the forest have become so greatly intoxicated by their prosperity. They have surrendered to an ordinary human being, Krishna, and thus they have offended the gods. Purport. By the disciples of Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Of course, Indra was really saying that the cowherd men had offended him, Indra, by taking shelter of Krishna, whom Indra considered to be Martya, a mortal. This was certainly a great miscalculation on Indra's part. And then text 4. Yatadrithai karma mayai. sorry. Kratu binama nau nipai vidyam. Anvikshi shi kim hitva titir shanti bavaranya nam. So that translation is as follows. Their taking shelter of Krishna is just like the foolish attempt of men who abandon transcendental knowledge of the self and instead try to cross over the great ocean of material existence in the false boats of fruitive ritual sacrifice. Okay. Om Gyana Timurandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshurin Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manopistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Uttapada Kamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Cha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Ragutanam Vitam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishaka Vitamscha. Hey Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapsa Kanchana Gorangi Radha Vrindavanishvari Rishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakalpatribhyascha Kripa Sindhubhye Vacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnebhyo Namo Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimataram Padaswami Iti Namine Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimata Bhaktivedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Navishesha Sunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaurabhaktivrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So I'll just read the English translation again. Text 2. Angry Indra sent forth the clouds of universal destruction known as Samvartika. Imagining himself the supreme controller, he spoke as follows. Text 3. Indra said, just see how these cowherd men living in the forest have become so greatly intoxicated by their prosperity. They have surrendered to an ordinary human being, Krishna, and thus they have offended the gods. And text 4. Their taking shelter of Krishna is just like the foolish attempt of men who abandon transcendental knowledge of the self and instead try to cross over the great ocean of material existence in the false boats of fruitive ritual sacrifices. So, Srila Kavi Karnapurna in Ananda Vrindavan Champu, he gives a very nice description of this particular moment when Lord Indra is actually making this decision to send forth these clouds of universal destruction. So I'm going to read from Srila Kavi Karnapura. Overcome, so this is referring to Lord Indra, overcome by revenge and frustration, Indra considered for a moment how to retaliate against the Vrajavasis. Angry Indra then released the powerful clouds of universal destruction known as Samvartaka. These clouds of universal destruction, closed inverted commas, that's reading from Srila Kavikarnapura. So there's a moment where Krishna, when Lord Indra is experiencing a sense of wanting to get his revenge, because the sacrifice intended for him was diverted by Krishna to a sacrifice to be performed for Govardhan Hill, for the worship of Govardhan Hill. So Indra has this moment of feeling frustrated and then wanting to actually seek revenge. So it's at that moment, with those emotions, that he releases these powerful clouds called the Samvartaka clouds. So these clouds of universal destruction, they refer to a Samvartaka. So that's mentioned in the first text we read, text 2. And there's also immediately after Samvartaka, there's the word cha. So cha indicates also that accompanying these Samvartaka clouds are seven winds of destruction, known as, or two of them at any rate, are Dvaha and Pravaha. So there's this sort of onomatopoeic sound for the winds. The Dvaha, Pravaha. And these were also sent by Lord Indra. So both the clouds and the winds. As generally one finds when one looks up into the sky, that the clouds are moving because of the motion of the wind. So these clouds came before Lord Indra, their master, and submitted the following words. So these clouds are seen as the servants of Lord Indra, and they actually converse with Lord Indra. So this is what they say. These are their words. We are your servants and always ready to execute your order. So, Srila Kavikarnapura in Ananda Vrindavan Champu, he writes, so this is his writing, to encourage his servants, meaning the clouds, Indra glanced at them with affection and appreciation as he addressed them. So there's a dialogue. So this is Indra's response to the clouds. Hung ho! Oh, my playful, speedy clouds, who are famous throughout the world for distributing profuse rain. Your pride in your power fills me with strength. Mount Manaka, the son of the Himalayas, continuously expanded, and how freely... Oh, sorry, I jumped a little bit. Here he is. Now make me successful by carrying out my orders. You have the unadulterated mood of destroying the whole creation within you. But this assignment involves only one small region. Go, shake the earth with your thunder and destroy the village of Vrindavan with a deluge. So this is the instruction Lord Indra is giving to his servants, which are these very intense clouds. And we'll come to hear something of what these clouds look like. But he's been very affectionate to them and calling them his speedy clouds, because remember, he's also sending the winds that accompany the clouds. And He's feeling very heartened by their presence. He communicates this to them. I mean, there's a little bit of projection, one could say, because he says that it fills him with a sense of power. He says that he's seen them as having pride in their power. But of course, we know that he's getting boosted by their presence, and he's the one who's carrying the pride in his power. Because after all, the clouds are sort of his extension. They're willing to serve him. Now, these Samvartika clouds, it's very interesting to look at them, because usually their purpose is that they're called upon to perform the service of destruction, but it's done at the time when destruction is to happen for the whole of creation. And so if these clouds had been called at the regular time where they're serving their proper purpose, the scenario would have been very different. This is how the scenario would have been for these clouds. And this is described in Srimad Bhagavatam in the 11th canto. This is how it would have been were they being summoned correctly and at the correct time and for the correct purpose. The Supreme Personality of Godhead in his form of eternal time, I'm reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, the 11th canto, 5th chapter, 8th verse. The Supreme Personality of Godhead in his form of eternal time withdraws the manifest cosmos consisting of gross and subtle features, and the entire universe vanishes into non-manifestation. Carrying on. So that same Kala that originally incited the female nature into manifestation again withdraws the cosmos into its original state of inert non-manifestation. So this would have been the actual setting. It's that the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the form of eternal time, so there's a duration by within which the universe exists, the four yugas. And at the end of the four yugas, and particularly the yuga we're living in, at the end of Kali Yuga, in the form of eternal time, so Krishna's considered time, the time, the duration of time in which the yugas are there and the universe is existing now comes to an end. And then what actually happens is that all the gross and subtle features start to get withdrawn, so that they become unmanifest. So this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself taking control of that, Lord Vishnu. And according to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, this time potency, so potency is the spiritual strength of Krishna or Lord Vishnu, that time potency is withdrawn and it merges into the Supreme Being or the Supreme Soul, who manifests himself as the original cause of material nature. So material nature can't actually proceed any longer. Time withdraws the power of material nature. So all the universes get withdrawn, all the gross, the way they're manifesting grossly, all those elements get withdrawn into the body of Lord Vishnu. So here's the next verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is actually how it would have worked for the Samvartika clouds. Here's the second painting the whole scenario. As the cosmic annihilation approaches, a terrible drought takes place on Earth for 100 years. So this is what we can expect at the end of Kali Yuga, because that will be the time of this withdrawal of the whole universe, all the universes. For 100 years, the heat of the sun gradually increases, and its blazing heat begins to scorch the three worlds. And then, this is Srimad Bhagavatam the ninth verse in the 11th canto, the fifth chapter. So beginning from Pataloka, so all the hellish planets, a fire grows emanating from the mouth of Sankarshan. Its flames directed upwards, driven by great winds, it scorches everything in all directions. So note, there's a whole control coming from the Supreme Personality of God that sets things into motion. The withdrawal of the material elements, this great fire beginning from Pataloka, and it is then, only then, and this is from Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, 3rd chapter, 11th verse. Hordes of clouds called Samvartika pour torrents of rain for 100 years, flooding down its raindrops as long as the trunk of an elephant. The deadly rainfall submerges the entire universe in water. So this actually is the setting, the choice made by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, just because the time element is there, that it's the correct time for the destruction to happen, the blazing fire, then the Samvartika clouds are coming. So 100 years of fire, 100 years of the Samvartika clouds pouring down their water. But notice Indra, he's saying, I know you have it in you, this capacity to destroy the entire universe, but in this particular case, you're just going to actually use your capacity for one small place on the earth, Vrindavan. So, and notice he's giving the instruction, not the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And it's also not the regular purpose of the Samvartika clouds or the regular service they perform. So, these clouds, with their inbuilt mood of destroying the entire creation, they were being released from the task of devastating the entire universe at a particular time. So they didn't have their regular task. Nevertheless, so it's a personality. These clouds are personalities, or there's personalities that personify the clouds. So the head personality is Samvartika. So he and other servants of Indra, they step forward very proudly to accomplish their mission. So here's a description of how they go about accomplishing their mission. First, a vast bank of clouds, appearing like a huge patch of moss in the sky, blocked out the sun and covered Vrindavan in total darkness. Extending from Rasatala to Svargaloka, the clouds covering everything look like the smoky breath exhaled by the Naga snakes. So that's a description of what, once they started to execute Indra's order, just to use this inbuilt mood of destruction on a very specific area of the earth, this is what it started to look like. But of course, it wasn't merely that, you know, Vrindavan was covered in darkness. It extended all the way to Svargaloka, so the heavenly planets, and down to the hellish planets. So sort of a great darkness is coming over everything. So this is coming from Srila Kavikarnapura's writings. Carrying on. Released from their bonds, a few ominous clouds, in the sportive mood of breaking the Kedara Mountains, quickly spread across the sky. These dense dark clouds then appeared as massive as the celestial elephants guarding the quarter of the globe, the quarters of the globe. Another group of dangerous clouds circled overhead.
the clouds, like Mount Manuka, the son of the Himalayas, continually expanded and moved freely in the sky without any fear of being cut by Indra's millions of thunderbolts. So they got their order, they were released from their usual task, but they proceeded to follow the order of Lord Indra. So it's very ominous, their presence, beginning with this darkness and then circling around. It's almost like you have animals when they're about to get their prey, they may circle their prey. They kind of corner their prey and they've got, they're ready to pounce. So similarly, some very dark clouds are circling overhead, you know, because there's ominous intentions. There's going to be a major deluge. So Indra himself, he considered himself to be the supreme controller. And this is Srila Vishvanatha Chakravarti Thakur in Sarita Darshini. So that supreme controller is defined. So here's Indra. You know, one can carry a concept of oneself. So sometimes you have very delusional people. Somebody may actually believe that they're head of a corporation, whereas in actual fact, they may be a simple worker in the corporation. So it's a kind of delusional thinking. So this is actually a definition of the supreme controller. So it's not Indra. The supreme personality of Godhead, although fixed in his abode, is more swift than the mind and can overcome all others running. The powerful demigods cannot approach him. Although in one place he has control over those who supply the air and rain, he surpasses all in excellence. That's from Sri Ishopanishad Mantra 4, and I'm particularly using this definition of the Supreme Personality of Godhead because it references what is the relationship between the Supreme Controller and those who are supplying the air and the rain. So Indra is in that category. So I'm going to read the Sanskrit from Sri Ishopanishad Mantra 4. Aneyat ekam manaso javiyo nama devi apnuvam purvam ashat tad davato nyan atyet tishtat tasmin apo matarishva dadati. So by his potency, the actual supreme controller, not Indra, by his inconceivable potency, he can reach every part of the creative energy. And because it says he's fixed in his abode, he's in one place, but he can reach anywhere in the creation. This is the supreme personality of Godhead. So to explain this, a comparison is made between a fire that can distribute its heat and its light, even though the fire is in one place. And the comparison is made to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who's in his one spot. He's in the spiritual world in Goloka Vrindavan. And at the same time, he's able to diffuse his different energies all over the creation. So that's the Supreme Controller. And such energies are principally divided into three. So he has an internal potency or spiritual strength. There's a marginal potency or his that spiritual strength that's marginal. And there's the external potency or external strength. So the dominating demigods, such as Indra, who are empowered to have control over the administration of natural phenomena, such as light, air, and rain, they all are classified within the marginal potency of the Absolute Person. So it means that sometimes, marginal means, you know, you're on the margin. So sometimes you can go into the internal potency of the Supreme Lord and sometimes not. So living beings such as humans, they're also products of the marginal potency of the Lord. And the material world itself is the creation of the external potency of the Lord, and the spiritual sky is the manifestation of his internal potency. So it's internal potency is like everything that is very close to the Supreme Controller, Lord Krishna's heart, that's manifested in the spiritual world, and there's no contradiction between what's external and what's internal. It's all complete and perfect. Marginal, sometimes one can actually be in the under the control of the internal potency of the Supreme Lord, and sometimes not. Means one comes to be under the control of material nature. So this is what the actual definition is of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, with his particular potencies or energies, and he's actually the creator. So just remembering that particular mantra, which defines the position of the Supreme Controller versus those that are under him, those that are in the marginal potency, such as the demigods. The powerful demigods cannot approach him, although in one place he has control over those who supply the air and rain. So that's who the Supreme Controller is. Now, as far as understanding of the Supreme Lord is concerned, this is how the reasoning goes. Because, you know, you have to look at, you know, how do you understand him, the Supreme Controller. Now, there's individual parts and parcels of the Lord. And although they've got the symptoms of the Lord, meaning there's this potential for eternal bliss and eternal knowledge, they actually have limited spheres of activities. So his activities, his energies can extend all over the universe. He can touch everything while being in one place. But those that are created by the Lord, they have limited spheres of activities. And for this reason, they're all limited. So one doesn't have the same capacity. It's not that, you know, one sits in one spot and because one desires something, it manifests somewhere else. One does not have that power. I mean, it's a yogic perfection. That's some yogis have that ability that, you know, they may think of something and summon it. So sometimes you've had yogis who will, you know, manifest ash from their hands or something. But that is not remotely comparable to the power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who actually can touch any corner of the universe at any time. So, Srila Prabhupada writes, therefore, the parts and parcels cannot approach the full potency of the Supreme Lord. Foolish persons who are parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord under the influence of the material energy try to make a competition. But obviously there's ignorance. There's some attempt at competing, but that's obviously ignorant because it's not understanding how one has a limited sphere of activity. You can only work within your sphere. Now, every part of the Supreme Lord is endowed with a particular energy to act. And forgetfulness by that part of his particular activities is called Maya. So, one should be very careful to play the part designated for him by the Supreme Lord. So this happens even in a very simple way. Let's say one is attempting to, you know, be under the shelter of the internal potency of the Supreme Lord, and one has a particular service to perform. There's clear parameters and boundaries for one's service. So if one steps out of those boundaries and tries to do the service of somebody else, one is in trouble. I mean, because one's intelligence is different from the person who's performing some other service. The knowledge one has of that service is not going to be the same because one's not practicing that service. And if one then takes the position of stepping into somebody else's service or area of work, there's bound to be quite a lot of trouble that's going to be caused. Just because one, you know, doesn't have knowledge of that area as perfectly as the person performing it. And also, one may not have the same capacity. So there's going to be trouble. So particularly, it's said here that if one is forgetting or going outside of the realm of one's activities, this becomes a kind of delusion or illusion. One falls into maya. You know, you have some idea that you know. You have some idea that you can do, but it's not factual. So actually, Srila Prabhupada writes, one should be very careful to play the part designated for one by the Supreme Lord. Now here we have Indra. He's offended by the cowherd men taking shelter of Krishna. So see how great is the delusion. He has the idea of himself as controlling everything in the universe. He's able to release the Samvartika clouds, even direct them, not to do the original purpose of functioning to destroy the entire universe at the time of destruction of the universe. He can tell them, just do the same activity within a very specific area. So he's actually offended that the cowherd men have taken shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, because he considers him just a regular little mortal. He's a mortal. I mean, Indra understands he's inhabiting the heavenly planets means there's much greater intelligence, much greater capacity, much greater ability to perform all kinds of activities. So Krishna in Vrindavan, on the earthly plane, from Indra's perspective, this is a mere human being. So much less capacity to perform a whole range of activities, much less intellect, much less understanding. So he's actually offended that the cowherd men are choosing to follow Krishna's direction. So, Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur particularly says this, and this was from text 3, Indra's sense of being offended by this action on the cowherd men that they're taking shelter of, because generally one looks to a superior being. So, one can try to know the transcendence, so meaning something of the position of somebody who is defined as being the supreme controller from a superior source, such as the Vedas, because the Vedas are considered to already have this knowledge of the transcendence or of the Supreme Lord and his position as a supreme controller. Now, if one takes like Indra's perspective of where the individual soul fits in, whether one's like, because he's in the marginal potency, he's under the control of the marginal potency, so is a mere mortal under the control of the marginal potency of the Supreme Lord. So if we consider what's the position of the individual soul, the individual soul has got this initiative to act. on his own. That's there. One has that initiative. Like in the temple, we're going to hear on Gaur Purnim that the temple has different initiatives. So it means there's action being taken in particular areas. So the individual soul can take this initiative to act on his own. And the proper use of one's initiative has to do with using it in such a way that one's active nature, with one's intelligence, you can only put it into action if you're carrying the understanding that everything around one is the potency of the Lord. It's his energies that are touching everything. So when you initiate something, you initiate some action as an individual soul, there has to be this understanding when you're initiating your action that everything is the potency of the Lord. Other beings that are there, the materials for performing one's actions, the interactions between individual souls, everything is the potency of the Supreme Lord. And this comes from Srimad Bhagavatam, again the 11th canto, and this is in the 15th chapter. And Krishna explains it in such an interesting way. Listen to this. A person who perfectly meditates on me acquires my nature of being the supreme ruler and controller. His order, like mine, can never be frustrated by any means. So this is very interesting. Notice Krishna is saying that if you're meditating on him, you're going to get his nature. You're going to actually be the supreme ruler and controller. Now, this sounds very odd, doesn't it? I mean, because I've just been painting this picture of the difference between the individual souls, be they mortals, be they demigods, and how they have to be so careful in terms of the initiatives they take or the actions they perform. And here it is, Krishna saying, you know, a person who's meditating on me, he's acquiring my nature of being the supreme ruler and controller. Very interesting. I mean, really interesting. And he even says that such a person, when they issue an order, it can't be frustrated by any means. And I'm going to even read that particular verse because it's fascinating. Maya Dakshena, I'm jumping a little bit. The whole creation is moving by the Lord's command. So just bear that in mind. Everything's moving under Lord Krishna's command. So he says, Maya Dakshena Prakriti, Suyate sa chacharam hetunanena konteya jagat viparu vartate. So this material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, O son of Kunti, producing all moving and non-moving beings. Under its rule, this creation is created and annihilated again and again. So how is it that the Supreme Controller is saying that meditating on him allows one to also become the supreme ruler and controller? How's that? So clearly, this is only so because when one is acting, utilizing one's active nature, going to perform some action, using one's intelligence, one is operating with the understanding that everything is the potency of the Lord. So what the materials one's going to use, the entities one's going to use to help one to perform one's particular actions, the entities that were there performing particular actions, all those are actually the potency of the Supreme Lord. It's his energy. One has to understand that. So you have to be carrying that understanding. And we heard early on, Lord Indra was carrying a different understanding. And this was given by our acharyas. He specifically is thinking of himself as the supreme controller. So one can understand that one can rule and control something, but one has to have the definite understanding that everything that's there that one's going to utilize to perform something, it's actually the potency of Lord Krishna. So it doesn't mean that now you're going to selectively have control a particular aspect that's going to work with your particular action that you're going to perform, and you're going to disregard, say, some other aspects that are there. You have to take everything into account, because everything is the potency of the Supreme Lord. So here, the three worlds appear to be born out of the darkness created by that ever-expanding cloud bank. So remember, we've got these ominous clouds circling around, and it begins to appear as though the three worlds are going to be born out of this darkness. So, you know, there's an appearance of some action. So the covering of the universe turned as black as the soot smeared on the bottom of a pot. However, this is the interesting thing. Even though everything appears like these clouds, you know, the universal destruction is going to happen, there's this huge darkness, these universal disturbances that were being caused by the release of the Samvartika clouds and the attack that they were going to perform, these devastating Samvartika clouds, it practically had no effect on Vrindavan. And the reason given that it had practically no effect on Vrindavan is because Vrindavan was continuously bathed in the moonlight emanating from Krishna's dew-like toenails. This is how it's put. There was a continuous glow because of Krishna's presence there. So actually, Vrindavan remained impervious to the attack of these ominous clouds. And this is Srila Kavi Kandapura's very eloquent, beautiful, putting into a couple of words the supreme controller truly controlling what Indra, thinking of himself as a supreme controller, was attempting to do with the asking his servants, the Samvartika clouds, to act. So if one translates it for us, like this idea that, you know, if you meditate on Lord Krishna, you then actually acquire his nature of being the supreme ruler and controller. For us, because there's sincerity in serving the Supreme Lord, many devotees actually take up the mission given by Lord Chaitanya, the most recent incarnation of Lord Krishna, and they repeat the command given by Lord Chaitanya. So they try and share Krishna's mystic opulence of giving orders that can't be counteracted. So, this is how one does it. One translates the order given by Lord Chaitanya, go and spread the message of, you know, the opulences and the beauty of Lord Krishna to the world. So sincere devotees having an understanding that everything is Krishna's energies, all these simple mortals functioning on the earthly plane, oblivious to Krishna's great opulences and great beauty and beautiful nature, they actually go out and they try and deliver this message of Lord Chaitanya. So in this way, they're actually can be considered to be acquiring Lord Krishna's nature or his supreme nature of ruling and controlling, because they are relaying his message. And nothing can stop that. So, so generally Vaishnavas who want to cross over material existence, they're taking shelter of the Supreme Controller, Lord Krishna. And here Indra, because of not carrying this understanding that everything is the potency and the energy of the Supreme Lord, including those Samvartika clouds, he says, he actually makes the statement, this is these are his words, these cowherd men have become absorbed in a sacrifice as a means to cross the ocean of material existence. The Vrajavasis have foolishly taken shelter of Krishna in hopes he will reduce the ocean in the water of material existence to that contained in a calf's hoof print. So he's critical of the Vrajavasis taking shelter of Krishna. He's saying it's they think it's going to help them to cross over, you know, material nature and all the suffering of material nature. They just think that. And he's correct that it's only when a living entity is conditioned within material nature, like all they see is what material nature is presenting to them. They're like at the mercy of their karma, perform their actions just from the karmic space, being almost impelled by nature to perform actions, then it's true. They actually don't have proper shelter. But for Indra to be criticizing the Vrajavasis to have taken shelter of the Supreme Controller, that they're at fault, thinking that in doing that they're now going to not be at the mercy of material nature, is clearly mistaken, because he's thinking his control of the Samvartika clouds is going to actually force them to see that they're at the mercy of material nature. So he's the one with the rebellious nature. Because he's not taking shelter of Lord Krishna at that particular moment in time. Because he's understanding, he's taking an initiative or taking an action that is not actually with the understanding that everything, all the elements there, this are persons, personalities, be they clouds, be they the Vrajavasis in Vrindavan, they're all part of Krishna's creation. They're part of Krishna's marginal potency. They actually are connected to Krishna. He's the one who's actually controlling. So Indra's rebellious nature has thrown him into a state of delusion. So that's just some thoughts on these three verses here, if there's any thought connected to this topic. We're waiting a moment for the microphone to return.
Sorry about that. I think
the microphone and the speaker behind the microphone has returned.
That's on you. Thank you for your class, Hare Krishna. You were mentioning, basically you were expanding on what the verse says, and you were mentioning Indra's faults, and you quoted many nice verses, the main fault, and you quoted some verses from, you know, various sources to indicate, you know, the distinction between the actual controller and Indra, who thinks he's just a controller. I kind of like to connect this point to kind of the class yesterday Ujjwala Prabhu gave, this many devotees gave the same kind of answer he did over the time, and I think it's a nice point to bring up again, because about fault finding. And so he quoted some very nice verse from Bhaktisiddhanta and other sources of how we shouldn't fault find, and Prabhupada says it many times. However, the devotees, they're not, you can't really categorize like black and white, you know, they say one thing one day and another thing the next day. That doesn't mean they're contradictions, that you apply different scenarios, lessons to different scenarios. And so this verse is describing Indra's fault. He thinks he's supreme control, and the verse mentions he's imagining very harsh words. The purport says he was arrogant. And we see Prabhupada call many people, either in general and sometimes specifically, fool, rascal, you know. And people are like, how can you talk like that? You're supposed to be a spiritualist, only looking at the good qualities. Well, one thing that came to mind is that we learn from Prabhupada, yes, and from the Srimad Bhagavatam, that we shouldn't look at others' mistakes. We should learn from others' mistakes, but according to Lajja, we can't learn from others' mistakes unless we look at others' mistakes. And so so that's very logical. And so there's a nice quote by Confucius. He says, if I am walking with two other men, each of them will serve as my teacher. I will pick out the good points of the one and imitate them, and the bad points of the other and correct them in myself. When we see persons of war, huh?
That's very nice.
Yeah, very nice quote. But there's also, he actually, these are two separate quotes, but they're both by Confucius. He actually expands on that. They're not in the same quote. Okay. But he says, when we see persons of worth, we should think of equaling them. When we see persons of a contrary character, we should turn inward and correct them in ourselves. And Prabhupada mentions this in the first verse of the Netta of Instruction. He says there are two types of people who learn from people's mistakes, those who see and those who hear. A foolish person has to see somebody commit a sinful activity like a thief, and in this way he'll learn that, you know, when you're a thief, you go to prison. Those who are more wise only have to hear that if you steal, then you'll go to prison. But those who are extremely foolish, they'll see, they'll hear, they'll perform in a criminal activity, get punished, and then they still do it again. So he's mentioning people's faults. And we also see in the Bhagavatam that Parikshit Maharaj, he asks many questions regarding the faults of others. Like, for example, Shukadeva Goswami, why did Dasha become so disturbed when Lord Shiva ignored him? Shukadeva Goswami never told Parikshit Maharaj, no, don't look at Daksha's faults. Look at your own faults. You know, you got disturbed when Shamika Rishi ignored you. So don't look at, no, we're meant to look at others' faults, not with the tendency to find fault, but how we could correct them in ourselves, learn from people. And one of the last points I'll mention is that we see in the chapter 2, verse 14 of the Gita. It says, persons, places, things, circumstances are like the weather. Sometimes they're good, and sometimes they're bad. However, Mahatmana Suman Partha Divam Prakritim Ashritaha. Later in the Gita in chapter 9, Krishna says, a wise person takes shelter in me. When the weather is good, it's nice. But when the weather is bad, what do? You take shelter inside a building. In much the same way, Krishna says, when your circumstances, people are not so nice, you take shelter in me, you build your character. And we never see a person say, you know, somebody may say, you know, the weather is nice today. It's so beautiful in the spring. But then a person may bust their bubble. Yeah, but the weather turns bad. He will never respond with, don't find fault with the weather, you know. You know, just see the weather's good qualities. That's impractical because we see an architect. Why does he, an architect, acquire the best materials? Because he knows the weather is going to turn bad. And so he looks at the weather's faults. The weather is not going to always be good. But there's a world of difference between those who just look at others' faults and don't build character, who just get some gratification from finding faults with others, and they're always miserable, and those who look at others' faults to build character when these circumstances are cold. So my question is, here's my question. When we look on yoga websites, spiritual websites, or, you know, any spiritual website, including ISKCON or whatever, generally speaking, they promote their society, their institution, and generally the promotion is this: if you come to our center or institution, there's peace, love, tranquility, harmony, people get along all the time. Yeah, that may be true, but not always true. And so when people come to, you know, any yoga place, any institution, people be disappointed. This is false advertisement. And so my question is, what are some steps we could do to not condition people to think everything in any spiritual environment, yoga environment, any well-being, it's always going to be good? Because if you put on your website, you know, there's going to be fault-finding, criticism, nobody's going to want to come. but actually that's reality, but there's another reality, build character. So I don't know if my question was clear, but maybe...
Yes, it's very nice.
Expand on those points.
You led to it very consistently. Well done, Joe Baladev. In fact, you were very on track. You built up the argument and there wasn't too much... There wasn't actually going into a tangent. You actually stayed very focused. Thank you very much. It's actually very nice.
This is a short comment. My brother actually said this. He says, I normally, and I agree with him, I give the puzzle pieces, and most of the time people have to put them together. So I go on a tangent, like you said.
Well, today was not like that. It was very clean and clear. So thank you very much for being so focused and following the argument logically that you were presenting to come to your question. So it's a very interesting question that looking at this point of you were highlighting the, is it necessary to look at, you know, the way somebody else has not functioned well so that you can actually learn from that, as opposed to just pointing a finger and saying, see, that person didn't do properly something. So you were highlighting that it seemed obvious that somehow the better route to take was to see what you could learn from that. And this is an interesting thing. I'm not sure that looking at the poor functioning or mistakes of somebody else necessarily builds one's character. I'm not sure. Because it's a little bit like you utilize the intellect to understand these actions were performed, this was the result, it wasn't a good result, or the actions performed were incorrect. One can analyze that way, but one may not know the internal psyche of the person. So looking from the outside, you can only learn sort of the face of the whole thing. You don't actually necessarily know the inner workings. And I think it's the inner workings that build character. So in many cases, the best learning comes from oneself going through something. So you can see, okay, these particular actions were mistaken actions because it led to this result. So that's a kind of knowledge you're carrying. Then you still, in your acting, have to maybe take that into account when you perform an action, but your character building is going to come from your performing actions and what transpires for you, because you have to make certain decisions based on some knowledge, maybe from observing somebody else acting in this particular area that you're going to act, but your learning will come from you performing the action, the decision you make to how you're going to act in that situation. That's where the learning will come, because actually your psyche may not be the same psyche as that person who went through something. That person may have made certain decisions, but you don't know the full psyche of that person. So your learning will definitely come from you performing the action, maybe with the knowledge of having learned from just externally what somebody else did, but you have to perform the action. And you have to make a decision too, often on how you're going to adjust something, how you're going to deal with others, how you're going to manage success or failure. Or maybe even one experiences success, but the world is telling one that there's a failure. But because of how your psyche is made up and because you perform something in the correct consciousness, that, you know, it's for the pleasure of the Supreme Lord one wishes to serve. The world may be viewing it as a failure, but one knows that in oneself, one made an offering to the Supreme Lord and one considers it a success. So the subjective component can't be taken away in learning. And it's very personal. It's very personal, and it may not be visible to others. So that's a comment on that character-building aspect. And then you brought up a second component, which is very interesting, that an institution may present a very positive scenario, like the outside advertising, you know, peace, love, tranquility, happiness. And in actual fact, one may then discover that actually when you enter the institution, things are not quite that way. There may be dissension, there may be aggression maybe even, there may be unkindness. So then, you know, you could say, well, you know, it was incorrect advertising. So that's a very good point, because the same way as it applies to the individual and their learning coming from their individual action, but of course armed with knowledge, the same thing applies to an institution. The institution will want to present a face. So the face may be, we are now transitioning from our previous something in some department. Now we're going to label it something else. So now we're going into a new and better version of the old. So publicly, everyone may say, ah, oh, nice. You know, change of name, some new energy, nice. Behind the scenes, one may not know what has happened behind the scenes. Behind the scenes, there may have been, you know, very kind actions, removing somebody from their work, their service. There may have been disregard of certain individuals and the work they were doing in the name of going for the new and better. One doesn't know those things. But the world will see the, ah, it's moved from this to that new label. Everything's perfect. Again, the individual's action in is the most important thing. The person who performs the action of making the switch, how they did it, in what consciousness they did it, how they actually took care of those that were performing work in a particular way, how they changed it to something else, how did they attend to the emotions, the caretaking of those that were part of the old picture. How did they create the new picture with what sensitivity was shown to the old? You know, there's all sorts of questions if one goes into it more deeply. But the external is generally, as you say, the perfect advertising. So, and you only know the inner when you're in the inner. And even when you're in the inner, your personal choices, how are you going to act in the situation will determine if you remain peaceful with a mood of loving whatever. That it's always individual choice and individual consciousness that will be one's greatest teacher. So, yeah. So those are some thoughts. Thank you so much for your very consistent, precise following through on logic today, Jayabala Dev. It's truly an achievement. Thank you.
Always respect it.
Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.